The Guardian.
Hi, I'm Ailsa Barry from the Natural History Museum, and you're listening to The Guardian Science Weekly podcast, and I'm about to bring some extinct creatures back to life.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. On this week's podcast,
we've discovered an organism that can substitute one element for another in these major biomolecules.
A discovery by NASA that could change how we think about life on Earth, and also change what we look for in outer space.
All life that we know of requires carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, oxygen, phosphorus, and sulfur.
Scientists discover a bacterium that seems to live on arsenic.
But the bottom line out of all this is that what you're looking at here is an exceptional claim.
We preview a new way of telling the story of evolution using a specially built kid-proof orange iPad.
It's certainly the only museum that's got locationally based augmented reality.
The Natural History Museum uses David Attenborough and a bit of techie magic to bring prehistoric animals to within touching distance.
You will see Australopithecus afarensis, an extinct hominid who lived about 3 million years ago.
We have some interesting thoughts on why we have to still pay a fortune for science journals.
If you go back to the fundamentals of how science should work, you should be standing on the shoulder of giants, and you shouldn't be hiding your research from some kid just because they can't afford it.
And our ever-changing relationship with Neanderthals.
They sort of shivered in sort of rags and fur, while we had sort of these parka jackets, you know, it was a survival of the snuggest.
Plus, what your fingers say about you.
The ratio of index fingers to ring fingers correlated to prenatal testosterone levels, which in turn seem to be correlated to prostate cancer or likelihood of getting prostate cancer.
This is a slightly fingers and thumbs edition of Science Weekly from The Guardian. Welcome, everyone. The Guardian's Nell Bowes is here in the studio, as well as the Observer's science editor, Robin McKee. Hello to you both.
Hi.
Hello.
This week, we're not going to hold back these news hounds as we go straight into our show and tell news section. We're going to start with, well, actually me. This is what I want to talk about, probably the biggest story of the week. NASA's discovery of a bacterium in a strange salty lake in California. It seems to thrive on arsenic and could redefine life as we know it. This bacterium, let's give it its full name, a GFAJ1 strain of the Halmondo Dacae. I've no idea if I spelled that, pronounced that correctly. Now, they don't merely eat arsenic, they actually incorporate the toxic element directly into their DNA. Before we get on to the discussion, let's hear what the experts had to say at NASA's much-anticipated press conference last week.
All life that we know of requires carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, oxygen, phosphorus, and sulfur. And it uses those six elements in some of the critical pieces I think we're all familiar with, including DNA and RNA, or the information technology of the cell, the proteins, which are the molecular machines, and the lipids, which separates you from everything else. And so by discovering, we've discovered an organism that can substitute one element for another in these major biomolecules. So here we're seeing the beautiful, elegant structure of the double helix.
By the way, this is Felisa Wolf-Simon, NASA astrobiology research fellow and author of the new paper.
If there's an organism on Earth doing something different, we've cracked open the door to what's possible for life elsewhere in the universe. And that's profound. And to understand how life is formed and where life is going. This microbe substitutes arsenic for phosphorus in its basic biomolecules. And what else might we find? What else might we want to look for?
They found the strain in California's Mono Lake, which was formed in a volcanic region and is very dense in minerals, including arsenic. The lake's also
teeming with life,
though not fish. Also speaking at the announcement was Stephen Benner, a chemist at the Foundation for Applied Molecular Evolution.
Pick another element, another medium other than arsenic.
He says that arsenic makes for a poor building block for DNA and thinks the bacterium's existence is the exception rather than the rule.
So we remember all this old chemistry and we don't believe it. And that's what you're going to see a lot of people saying. Now, keep in mind, old chemistry can be wrong. And in fact, one of the wonderful things about being in a science is, as Richard Feynman would say, science begins when you distrust experts. And of course, as the expert in chemistry, I'm saying that you should distrust me. But the bottom line out of all this is that what you're looking at here is an exceptional claim based on the context of the chemistry. And of course, when we can go into great details about what experiments you might do in the future to explore this. But what Felisa has produced is a very, very useful system to go ask these kind of questions.
The finding extends what scientists know about the variety of life forms on Earth, and it might even expand where we should look for life on other planets and moons.
I was going to say, I mean, it's very interesting, but it's no more than that, is it? It's not exactly, we haven't found aliens out there. It's, I mean, this was all over the blogosphere, wasn't it? And, you know, what we've got is kind of an interesting bug that does something very slightly different.
No, quite. I mean, it does extend biology for molecular biologists. It's really exciting. I mean, it's published in Science, so, you know, the research is sound. Actually, one of the authors on this paper is one of our favourites, Paul Davis, who sort of hinted at this a while ago when he was in the UK. He's talking about second genesis of life. And this isn't that, by the way, but when he was giving his lectures about, you know, the Eerie Silence, his latest book on extraterrestrials, he said, you know, we might start looking for life that evolved completely differently to, well, a second branch of evolution, essentially, on Earth. So if it evolved twice on Earth, then it's more likely that we're going to find life elsewhere in the universe. It's a hypothesis. And he said that one way of thinking about life evolving was if it used completely different chemicals to us. So the DNA was different in some fundamental way. Now, this particular bug or microbe isn't that thing that he was sort of talking about. It's not the shallow biosphere, as he calls it, which is this whole biosphere of molecule microbes out there using different chemicals and all of that. But it indicates that life is more, you know, versatile than we think.
When we're looking for life on other planets, Alok, are we looking for a particular signature of these six chemicals alone, or are we looking for some other kind of indication of complexity that isn't based on those particular chemicals?
So the stuff out there, when we're looking for life, we're looking for things that would either support life, so elements that a life form might want to breathe or metabolize, for example. Or in fact, we look for complex organic molecules, so amino acids, DNA perhaps, those sorts of things. These are hard to find. You don't tend to look for the individual elements. Having said that, the six elements that we know are make up all the biomolecules on Earth, so these six, which are carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, oxygen, phosphorus, and sulfur, everything, adenosine triphosphate, the stuff that we use for energy, DNA, all of the molecules inside our bodies, fats, lipids, proteins, everything was made from a combination of these six elements plus a few other bits and pieces. And if we add arsenic to that, we need to be looking for that as well out there. We need to find, and perhaps that's not interesting on Earth. I mean, arsenic is not the most stable compound making thing for biomolecules, as we've said. But if you're looking for life on Titan, for example, which is much colder, it might have more conducive situations where arsenic-based bacteria might actually live. That's interesting. And you know, it does change a little bit these sort of things we're looking for elsewhere.
So can you tell us a bit about how the story broke about, because there was a lot of hype about this before Science actually released the paper, wasn't there?
Yeah, as Robin mentioned, it was all over the blogosphere. And what happened was that the embargo for Science, it usually lifts on a Thursday evening, 7 o'clock GMT. And so most journalists had the story a week in advance. But what NASA did, and NASA had funded partly funded this research, and the press conference you heard earlier was arranged by NASA. They announced that there was going to be a press conference on Thursday when the embargo broke, but they announced it on the Monday beforehand. And they said something cryptic like, we're going to have these five astrobiologists and chemists who look at alien life or want to look at, you know, the sort of possibilities for alien life. But these five people are going to be in a room at a major press conference where we're going to announce something major about astrobiology. I mean, it was a real sort of red rag, really, to the people who were interested in this stuff. And so everyone started speculating. Sensible journalists who didn't have the press released information started ringing around and thinking, what could this be? One of our colleagues on the tabloids here, The Sun, they got a story which was pretty much right, actually. They just guessed what it might be. They rang up sort of a scientist and said, well, what could this be? And then by about Thursday, it was already 350, 400 blog posts, stories, there was Twitter going around everywhere saying they found a bug that essentially lives on arsenic. People were sort of speculating whether this is literally an alien overlord that had appeared. I think support groups were being set up, all sorts. And all this time, Science kept its embargo. So journalists like us, who had written a story, we knew what was happening, we couldn't say anything. I mean, it's a mistake on their part. They should have really cut the embargo Tuesday or Wednesday and stopped the speculation, because what happened was for 2 days, 3 days, nonsense was just being peddled all over the world.
Right, okay, what I've been working on this week is human life, not microbial life. It's been a sort of big year for Neanderthals, as it were, particularly with the publication of the Neanderthal genome by Svante Paabo and his colleagues in Leipzig. And a lot of other good science has been done about these, you know, sort of cousins of Homo sapiens. And we're getting closer to answering the question, why did they die out 35,000 years ago? And why did Homo sapiens take over the world? Some people think that the evidence that Svante Paabo pulled up, which showed that a little bit of Neanderthal genes have gone into some members of Homo sapiens and some non, shows that really the two species were very, very, very similar. And really it was just luck that doomed them and put us onto the road to success. I don't think the evidence shows that. I think there was a fundamental intellectual difference between them and between ourselves. And the evidence, there's a lot of evidence, again, that's come out in the last few months that backs that up.
Many years ago, the received wisdom is that these two species lived side by side, and eventually our species clubbed the others to death.
Yes, well, I mean, don't forget, if you go further back in that, to say 30, 40 years ago, there are people of the multi-regional hypothesis arguments, like Wolpoff in Chicago, argued that we evolved from Neanderthals in Europe. Now, that's been fundamentally disproved. It's just shown to be nonsense that, in fact, we came out of Africa about 100,000 years ago and slowly moved into Europe where the Neanderthals were. For a time, yeah, there was an argument that we basically clubbed them to death and you know, it was genocide. That argument is not necessarily over. There are arguments, people who believe that is what happened.
And Robin, last week New Scientist, their cover story was on Neanderthals, but they seemed to come to the conclusion that we were in some ways sort of a miscegenation, almost one species,
yes,
rather than two separate.
Yes.
How does that fit into everything?
It depends also what you call a species, actually. Some people say, were we two subspecies of the same species? I don't think so. I think we were two definite, very different species. After all, you can look at a Neanderthal skeleton, and even to the untrained eye, that's not us. You know, so really we, you know, it's just so obvious that the physical differences.
Now, we were the differences close between humans of different, you know, of pygmies and humans that evolved very tall.
But the skull, there's no eye, you know, there's no kind of eyebrow, eye ridges, there's no, you know, it just looks very, very different. Yes, these are just of scale, not of actual fundamental, you know, morphological difference. Oddly, but on the other hand, we were obviously close enough that some kind of interbreeding took place, albeit on a very small scale.
And so this was the next stage, and what I was going to say was that of 40 years ago, we thought that we'd clubbed them all to death. And then as further evidence came along, we found that interbreeding was happening.
Yes.
And there's a lot of interbreeding happening, in fact. And once the DNA evidence came along, actually, people in the world have Neanderthal DNA still.
Yes. And so that, again, there was a sort of reaction. And that's where I think the New Scientist article comes from. It's kind of, look, we must be so similar we should be considered the same species. But if you look at some of the other evidence that's come up, there's a place called Grotte de Rennes in France where they found this wonderful layer of Neanderthal finds, which beautiful artistic work, you know, sort of jewellery. And everyone pointed out and said, look, the Neanderthals were capable of just the same kind of wonderful things that we were. And have gone back to that and dated it and found out that most of the stuff that they're saying was Neanderthal was actually made long after the Neanderthals had died, therefore could not have been made by them. And only one conclusion is that they were actually made by modern humans, and that these layers of archaeological layers have got mixed up, as happens.
So,
I mean, that's a real fundamental blow to the idea that these people were artistic, symbolic. You could think symbolically and artistically the way that we could.
So why did Homo sapiens survive in the end then, if it wasn't for violent reasons?
Well, violence could have come into it, but what was the intellectual tricks that we were capable of? We were very opportunistic, very inventive. We would look at things and go, hey, I can see a use for that, that they just couldn't do. The two that I thought were particularly interesting, one is that we clearly made sewn garments. We worked out the concept of a needle that they had not done. And so they sort of shivered in sort of rags and fur. Well, we had sort of these parka jackets, you know, as it was a survival of the snuggest. You know, we were out there in the cold. And the other one was that we were capable of developing projectile weapons. And by that, I mean spear throwers. These sort of sticks with little hooks at the end, and you can use it to throw a spear much, much further than you can if you just throw it like a javelin. And that means you can see a saber-toothed tiger and you want to kill it, or you're more likely a mammoth, you can do it far off. You don't go up close and annoy the creature and then get stamped on.
Nell, so we've had the origin of humans and the origin of perhaps life on Earth. What have you got for us? What's your really intellectual addition to this debate?
Oh, God, I feel I'm going to the party with a tiny, tiny, tiny thing. So I just wanted to bring along the story this week on hand pattern and prostate cancer, just because. So this was an article published in the British Journal of Cancer. It's just a short communication, just a little thing, and talking about the ratio of index fingers to ring fingers being correlated to prenatal testosterone levels, which in turn seem to be correlated to prostate cancer, or likelihood of getting prostate cancer. And it sparked another of those flurry of stories about, look, I can see Robin is checking his hands at the moment. I'm just going, which one's longer? Okay, so hold up your hand.
Which hand?
Hold up your left hand.
Okay, left.
Count hand. Round from your thumb.
Yes.
Okay, the first finger is your index finger.
Yes.
The second one is your middle finger.
Yes.
The third one is your ring finger.
Oh,
this is the crucial one.
And the fourth one is your little finger. And so your key ones are your index finger and your ring finger.
Yeah.
And if, for example, you're a city trader and you've got a long ring finger, then that implies that you take more risks and therefore may be more successful. It's pretty tenuous.
Actually, even from here, I can see the length of Robin's ring finger. That's enormous.
Wow, that's amazing.
Look at the size of that. Put it away.
That man's a rich and aggressive chap. Look at him.
What does it mean if your thumb and little finger are bigger than all your others put together?
it means you need to go and see the doctor.
It means you've had an accident, Andy. Does this work for women as well? Because I've got something written here that says you can tell, according to an article by Tim Dowling in our very own paper, it says you can tell whether or not you're a lesbian. A California study looking at the fingers of 720 men and women from San Francisco showed that lesbian women tended to have the more masculine, i.e. long ring finger, short index finger arrangement. So if you're a woman and you have longer ring finger than index finger, according to this very tenuous study.
Looking at my hands, I seem to be straight.
You're completely lesbian. I mean, you're not really supporting the science of this, are you? No,
I'm just, what I'm interested in is why
we're so obsessed
these kinds of stories do tend to get picked up regularly, and what is attractive about them? Is it that people find that they can sort of react to them?
We just show what's attractive, actually, because you can do them. You can do the test yourself.
You instantly want to look at the test.
So I think that listeners should go and test all of these things by themselves. If you are interested in that, by the way, there's a whole list of what your fingers say about you on the Guardian Science website. So if you go to guardian.co.uk/science, you'll find a sort of very interesting
and
accurate list of things. And also the NASA story, the microbe story, and also Robin's story about Neanderthals is also there. And also, if you're interested in updates on the NASA story, by the way, we've got a story tracker running on that, which lists all the various articles and things that have come out in the past week on that story, and you can also leave comments there. You can follow this podcast on Twitter. If you do that, we'll let you know every time a new episode is magicked onto the ether. Just search for Science Weekly. And for the rest of the Guardian Science content, follow Guardian Science.
I think I'm a lesbian.
Now he tells us.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk with Alok Jain.
Augmented reality is bringing dinosaurs back to life and to within touching distance. London's Natural History Museum has just unveiled its new interactive film, Who Do You Think You Really Are? It's narrated by a familiar voice, that of David Attenborough. Producer Andy attended the premiere with some of the most unforgiving critics around, a few dozen school children.
Welcome to the Attenborough Studio, and a unique opportunity to meet some of the scientists here at the museum and learn more about the wonders of the natural world. I'm going to take you on a journey to discover who you really are and where you came from.
Essentially, what we've created is a story back through your evolutionary past, where we can see how we have evolved from the earliest life forms and how much we've actually still continue to share with a whole range of life forms. In fact, we share a large percentage of our DNA with a banana.
This is my colleague Jackie, who runs this lab, and she's going to help us get the DNA out of our banana.
I'm Ailsa Barry, Head of Interactive Media here at the Natural History Museum, and I was the executive producer and co-writer for the film.
But you're not just going to sit there listening to me. You're going to be part of the experience, and you'll be able to examine some of the evidence for evolution along the way.
What we wanted to do was to use a whole arsenal of different media and technologies to bring that kind of theory alive.
This bony friend appearing on your own screen now will help you keep track of your journey by collecting gifts that the museum scientists will give you during the film.
It is all one worm, and it measures somewhere around 7 to 8 metres in length.
One of the many features that we share with all mammals. So here you go, and take care of it.
If you have a look at your screens now, you can rotate the modern human skull.
It's not a sit back and look film. You have to do things all the way through it, so you are all the time being asked to participate, to engage. We've also put a few unexpected things in there, a few unexpected anecdotes and jokes and ways that you might look at things slightly differently. So it keeps people on their toes. And I think the time goes very, very fast.
You can move your screen around to follow, but just be careful not to bump into the person next door to you. If you keep looking for the screen, you'll see Australopithecus afarensis, an extinct hominid who lived about 3 million years ago. You'll see Coelophysis, one of the dinosaurs that lived at the same time as our mammal ancestors.
At one point, there was a dinosaur walking across the stage.
There was. That's our augmented reality. So that actually creates a window into the past where you can see dinosaurs in the studio moving around, and they're actually blended into the studio, so you can see your mate and the dinosaur at the same time.
Next to your seat, you'll see a small orange computer, like this. Take it out, and using the touch-sensitive screen, enter your name.
What you get is a handheld computer, which we have built here at the museum, and we had to build it in a bespoke way because of both what we wanted to do, but also we needed to make it robust enough for 60 kids to come through and drop it and do everything else that people do in an audience.
Your screen also has a built-in camera. Let's use it to take a photo of ourselves. After all, this film is about you and me. Hold it up, look into it. Make sure your face is in the oval. Watch the countdown and smile.
There's a camera that's taking your picture. There's a camera that's looking out and actually allowing you to have the augmented reality in there. So the augmented reality is actually a combination of live video streaming that's coming in, so you're seeing the background coming in, against computer animation, which is being mixed together. So you get the sense that the model you're looking at is within the video streaming that you're seeing. So it actually looks like you're looking into a window. What we've done is we've peppered the whole studio with infrared so that actually that allows the camera on the computer to track that and actually locationally based it, which is why you get the correct positioning of the dinosaur, for example, within the studio.
We started this film with a question: who do you think you are? And we can end it with an answer. You are undoubtedly, like every other living thing on Earth, a member of one single family of life, descended from a common ancestor living thousands of millions of years ago.
That was the first time you've really tested it with a school audience. What's the reaction? How are you feeling?
Well, a bit relieved, actually. It was a bit nerve-wracking to see 60 kind of kids walk in.
So, let's have a look at your answers on the main screen.
They were very quiet, and then they actually told each other to shush when, you know, there was inappropriate jokes going ahead.
When your baby is born, everyone wants to know which relative they look like.
They laughed at the right jokes, and I think David Attenborough, of course, is brilliant in the way he presents and makes things extremely clear.
Okay, guys,
So David may be the best science teacher you could ever hope to have, but even he can't stop the teenagers bursting into fits of giggles at the mere mention of Homo erectus. We've got a preview of the film on our website, by the way. There's a link on our Facebook group. Search for The Guardian's Science Weekly podcast. You wait 4 years, then two nominations come along at once. Yes, this very thing you're listening to right now has been nominated in the science category for the podcastawards.com podcast awards. The voting has opened, and this allows you to give something back for all our hard work. Start voting now, podcastawards.com, and click on Science Weekly, please. Now, last time we pathetically begged for votes, it was so that producer Andy could make his mum proud, and I'm pleased to say that she is now very proud of him. This time is to help heal rifts with his father, who's just really disappointed that he didn't become an accountant. The Guardian's Football Weekly podcast is also nominated in the Sports section of the Year Awards, so click on that too if you have an extra 3 seconds. That's podcastawards.com.
We are allowed to use fake emotional blackmail, aren't we?
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk.
Now, just a little something we thought you science types would be interested in. We had Joy Ito in at The Guardian recently. He's an entrepreneur and venture capitalist. He's also the CEO of Creative Commons. They're the people who deal with online copyright issues, basically trying to make it easier for people to share and build on the work of others.
Creative Commons.
Anyway, we were eavesdropping on an interview he was doing for our Tech Weekly podcast.
No, you don't get any ideas from me.
I only bring it up because he said something interesting about science journals, and in the spirit of WikiLeaks, we thought it'd be best to share it with the whole world.
It used to cost more money to distribute information, to convene people, and to research. And this is kind of what universities did. And in the old days, to get the physics journals from Oxford and Cambridge over to MIT cost a tremendous amount of money and energy to organize these peer reviewers, even though they weren't being paid, and to create this infrastructure of connecting these institutions of higher learning together. And what was happening was you were in a world of scarcity. You had a scarce number of teachers. You had a scarce number of the amount of money to put all this together. So you had to be very careful to make sure you were educating the smartest people in society, that you were that these papers were the best because they were the ones being shipped across by boat to the new world and all this other stuff. And so the institutions that were created, the academic journals and the universities, were really the gatekeepers to make sure that the resources of society were being used to fund the best research and to educate the best researchers. The difference now is with the internet is it doesn't cost that much money to distribute the information, to convene the people. You still need some physical convening, but now suddenly you have students who can sit around and watch YouTube videos and TED videos in Africa and get excited and think about these things. And those journals that used to cost $10,000, $20,000 to subscribe to, that were the fundamental bedrock of communication between the Oxford scientists and the Cambridge scientists and the Tokyo University scientists, that journal that whose business model was necessary to keep this transmission going, now is the barrier to access because all the schools who can't afford it can't get in. Now, if you think about it, they played a really important role, and these universities played a very important role, so I don't want to diminish the importance of those institutions, but they are based on a fundamental idea of scarcity when we now have abundance. And when that has switched, what's happening is that you're creating these very weird, fake boundaries. And gatekeeping for academic journals is a tremendous problem because we now have the ability to access all the minds all over the world, which we didn't have before, and to bring them into the conversation. And if you go back to the fundamentals of how science should work, you should be standing on the shoulder of giants, and you shouldn't be hiding your research from some kid just because they can't afford it, right? That just for your own prestige. That doesn't make sense at a high level. It might make sense at a personal level if you're thinking about your tenure, if you're thinking about your position. But if you think about it, is that the right way we should be running science? Is that the right way we should be learning? Is that the right way we should be teaching? Because it doesn't really make sense. Because the fact that you teach more people, your idea goes to more people, doesn't diminish the value of your idea. It should actually increase it. So maybe some academics have some weird incentive to publish in a closed journal for their career. But if that's the case, I would argue that the way that we're incentivizing academics is wrong. Because having more people in the conversation, as long as the conversation is able to be managed and able to be paid for, can't, in any logic that I can imagine, be a good thing for progress. Now, many academic publishers don't even allow you to make copies of your own paper, right? Now, if you took the prestige and the career part of the researcher part away, who in their right mind would think that's a good idea, that a researcher couldn't copy their own paper and send it to some student who couldn't afford it? I mean, how can you argue that's a good idea for science?
I can't access articles that I've written, which I think is preposterous. I wrote them. I'd like to have them, you know, either in a physical form or in a digital form. Right. So we're on the same page.
And I think academia would argue, and many cases validly, that if you took away their business model, they would collapse. And if they collapse, the system that we've created to put these smart people together to make sure that the conversation was sufficiently rigorous would collapse, and research would go into, you know, a populist mush of smithereens. And so I would argue that, you know, it's a transition that we have to do. But we're not going to make that transition by trying to prevent access to knowledge.
The Guardian's Alex Krotowski there, speaking to Joy Ito from Creative Commons. If you have thoughts, then you know the drill: Twitter, Facebook, or our blog. Or you can write producer Andy a letter. He loves getting them. You can hear more of that interview in our Tech Weekly podcast, guardian.co.uk/techweekly.
Remember, vote for the Guardian Science Weekly podcast at podcastawards.com. Vote early. Vote often.
Right, that's it. We've blasted you with enough facts from our science plasmatron for one day. Now, later this week, Thursday in fact, we've got a special podcast from the Climate Change Conference in Cancun, presented by erstwhile science podder James Randerson. He'll be in London with John Vidal and Suzanne Goldenberg in Mexico. But returning to our regular programming, on Monday, incoming! Continuing our recent Doomsday theme podcasts, Ted Neild will give us sleepless nights about meteors hitting the Earth, and he'll tell us about the controversial research into the Great Ordovician Biodiversity Event. Don't want to miss that, do you? Don't forget to add your voice to our conversation at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. And make sure you subscribe to this podcast while you're there, so that every programme gets automatically delivered to your MP3 player. This podcast was produced by Andy Duckworth. I'm Alok Jha. Thanks for listening. Incoming. Incoming? Incoming. What?
Just do that. Incoming! Maybe go away from the mic a little bit.
Incoming! Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. I sounded quite surprised about that, didn't I? Even though it's here in front of me and I do this every week. Incoming!
How are you, chaps?
Tickety-boo, ready to go. Then I'll do the bloggy thing. Okay.
People might not think that you know what blogs are, Robin. I'm just saying. I'm just saying.
What, I mean,
such a bitch.
All right, fine. Let's do it that way.
Fine.
Let's do it that way.
Robin, fine. If you could say the word bloggosphere somewhere as well.
I was told by my daughter that the bloggosphere was going ablaze.
I understand the bloggosphere was ablaze over there. All good.
I'm sorry, Robin. That was an uncalled for statement.
But I'm used to it.
Incoming! Who do you think you are? It's narrated by a familiar voice, that of David Attenborough.
It's actually Who Do You Think You Really Are, sorry.
It has just unveiled its new interactive film, Who Do You Really Think You Are?
Who Do You Think You Really Are?
It has just unveiled its new interactive film, Who Do You Really... You should never put a verb at the end of a sentence like that. It's just wrong. No, actually, no, that's right. No, it's prepositions at the end of sentences that are wrong. That's right. Sorry, grammatically, I don't know anything. Incoming. Anyway, we eavesdropped. Incoming. Oxygen, carbon, phosphorus, sulfur, and one other. I was trying to find the list as I was saying that. Where is it? Incoming. Interview he was doing for our Tech Weekly sister podcast. I only bring it up
because Tech Weekly sister podcast. So yeah. What, you have a podcast about Tech Weekly sisters?
Yeah.
Who are particularly good with
sister with an A.
With sister iPods and things. Yes, okay.
It's if you think about it, it's not our sister podcast at all. It's our daughter podcast, because it started off on this very show, and then it was spawned off by itself.
Really?
Yeah, that's right.
It evolved.
Alex Kratosky's first podcast appearance of The Guardian was on this very podcast.
Really?
And so is Bobby Johnson's, I'll have you know, but Bobby's obviously not there anymore. And Charles Arthur's, for that matter.
Brian Cox, are we claiming him?
But Brian Cox was on his podcast well before he became well famous. It's true. And he even thanked me for being on it once.
Who else? What about David Attenborough?
Yeah, I think we might have to give him up to the
David Attenborough,
the
Stephen
greater.
Hawking, Darwin. Darwin was one of our first guests, I seem to remember.
If Darwin was alive, he'd be on this podcast.
He was rubbish.
He'd be on this podcast. Incoming? Guardian.co.uk/techweekly. I hope they're plugging us as well.
They are.
Right, that's it. We've blasted you with enough facts from our science plasmatron. Right, that's it.
Good outtakes.
Incoming.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.